Salo for Lover, this is Pacific Waves from RNZ Pacific. I'm Susanna Suisuiki. Coming up,
Samoans are resilient and there doesn't seem to be any panicking or unnecessary buying up of any products.
Getting rid of mosquito breeding grounds requires national effort. Also, the race is seemingly tight to form the next Solomon Islands government. And
we do have a lot of traffic coming in and out of our port.
The Marshall Islands puts a lid on illegal fishing. Samoa has recorded 34 new cases of dengue fever in the past week. This brings the current total cases reported since November last year to 250. The Health Ministry is organising mass cleanups and fumigation missions to combat the outbreak. Tiana Haxton has more.
People aged 60 years and over make up the most of the current cases, with the majority in northwest Upolu and Apia. In response, Samoa's government announced a national clean-up day for Friday, encouraging the general public to eradicate mosquito breeding grounds. Penina Health Trust Chief Executive Ronnie Leialai Auloto has been working alongside community leaders involved in the campaign.
There's a half day today for all government workplaces because people have to go and help out locally to do some of the work like getting rid of risks. Things like barrels of water that are sort of sitting there festering, grounds for mosquitoes to breed and things like that.
Leialai Auloto says it's commendable how people in Samoa are handling the outbreak.
Samoans are resilient and there doesn't seem to be any panicking or unnecessary buying up of any products. Because also locals have their beliefs on what they can use as well, you know, to deter mosquitoes.
She says the community is remaining calm and collected as they work together to combat the outbreak. Professor Cameron Simmons of the World Mosquito Program predicts the outbreak will slow down over the dry season, which is usually when temperatures drop.
The outbreak in Samoa is most likely the winter. When it gets a bit cooler, the mosquito population will shrink naturally. That's what it does every winter. And that will probably be the biggest influence on slowing the current outbreak.
In the meantime, he urges the community to follow the local health ministry's recommendations. This includes wearing clothing that covers all visible skin, using insect repellents, and removing stagnant water sources around their homes where mosquitoes will breed.
The race to form the next government of Solomon Islands could be a tight one, with no single party emerging from the election with enough seats to govern. Former Prime Minister Manasi Sogavare's Our Party did the best, securing 15 out of the 50 seats in the House. The former opposition leader, Matthew Wiley's Democratic Party, is first runner-up with 11 MPs, which is also equal to the number of independent MPs that have been elected. As for the rest of the field, the United Party secured 6 seats, the People's First Party won 3, and the remaining 4 minor parties won a seat each. So what happens now? Croy Hawkins sat down with the acting clerk to Parliament, Jefferson Halu, to try and answer this question.
The next step now is to form a government, to have the required number of the majority, at least 26 members of Parliament to form a government. So once the parties organise themselves and once they find the required majority, then they'll inform the government house for His Excellency the Governor General to set a date to elect the Prime Minister.
Is there any timeline, any estimate, anything to indicate what period that could take, or is there any limitations on how soon or how soon you have to do it?
There's no express timeline given to form a government or when the election of Prime Minister should take place after a national general election. With the election of the first sitting of Parliament and election of the Speaker. It's quite flexible. It gives time for the parties to organise themselves and find that majority.
In terms of who the Prime Ministerial candidates are, is that just internally decided, or are the party leaders automatically the Prime Ministerial candidate for that party? How does that work? How do they choose and select and nominate a Prime Minister?
I think that's a party work, related work. In order to form the majority, you need to have 26, at least 26 members of Parliament. Now we see two parties which have more than 10 and all almost have a similar footing, but they both need at least twice that amount, a number of members to form a government. So what will happen in the coming days and weeks is to try to get more members on board to have that required number to form the majority and therefore for the government.
Maybe turning to the election of the Prime Minister, just people probably wondering how that works. How does that work? Or how does the election of the Prime Minister work once they turn up here?
Usually in the past, the election of Prime Minister takes place in the Parliament House, but it is not a parliamentary proceeding per se. It's a meeting of members, and His Excellency the Governor General presides over the election of the Prime Minister. Once the Prime Minister is elected, and he appoints his cabinet ministers, thereby having a executive government in place, and then the Prime Minister would advise the Governor General to set a date to summon Parliament.
And the vote, how is it carried out?
By secret ballot. There will be a call for nominees for the PM's post, and then a secret ballot will be held and conducted by the His Excellency, the Governor General.
What happens if there's a tie?
If there's a tie, there are processes in place to undergo in order to find the Prime Minister elect. It depends on the number of candidates. So once you have more than two, for example, three or four, and there is a tie, then it goes through an elimination process. The one with the least votes doesn't make it to the next round. And it goes on and so forth until they find a member who has collected the majority of the votes required.
The Marshall Islands has ratified a United Nations agreement to fight illegal fishing. This is the first binding international agreement to specifically target IUU, or illegal, unreported and unregulated fishing, by preventing foreign vessels from using ports and trading in illegally caught fish. I spoke with the Chief Fisheries Officer, Bo Bigler, who says the agreement on port state measures has been a long time coming.
We believe that the work that we've been doing for the past few years, and at least a few years before COVID, have prepared us to be on par, or if not beyond, the PSMA. So we feel that it's the right time for us to sign on to the PSMA.
Since the early 2010s, the Marshall Islands capital, Majuro, has developed into the busiest tuna transshipment port in the world, with hundreds of transshipments of tuna from purse seiners to carrier vessels for later shipment to canneries worldwide. Mr. Bigler says while illegal fishing hasn't been a major issue in recent times, it still needs to be carefully monitored.
We do have a lot of traffic coming in and out of our port, and most of the vessels are fishing elsewhere, so we do play a big role in that aspect of the fishery.
The agreement outlines the requirements that foreign vessels must comply when entering ports. Mr. Bigler says the agreement will be beneficial to the Marshall Islands.
Yeah, there are many requirements and mechanisms within it that require information about vessels using our port, and more so, you know, two-way communications with flag states and other parties, such as coastal states and other RFMOs. But I think what it does for us is, you know, bind us to a group and an arrangement and agreement that does strengthen this combating against IUU fishing.
Mr. Bigler says he hopes more Pacific countries will also ratify the agreement. The Global Civil Society Alliance, Civicus, has raised concerns about Papua New Guinea's failure to set up a human rights body and moves that it says stifle the media and freedom of expression. The Asia-Pacific researcher for Civicus, Joseph Benedict, says PNG was called on by UN's Human Rights Council 2 years ago to set up a National Human Rights Commission, but he says this is still yet to happen. At the same time, he told Don Wiseman, the government has passed legislation and is considering other measures that could further harm freedom of expression and the rights of journalists.
Well, I think Civicus monitors the state of civic space across the globe. And in Papua New Guinea, in our recent brief, we have serious concerns about the state of freedom of expression. We have documented reports of, you know, restrictions, harassment against the media and journalists, and the lack of protection for them. We are concerned about the ability of groups to organize protests and to hold them. There are still restrictions in the law. There are laws like the Cybercrime Act, which is a criminal defamation law, which creates a chilling effect for those who want to speak up online and to raise issues. And most importantly, I think we're concerned about the lack of progress around the protection of human rights defenders, particularly with the failure to establish a national human rights institution that was recommended by the UN Human Rights Council 2 years ago, as well as the lack of access to information and a law on freedom of information. So these are some of the broad areas that Civicus has documented and are concerned about.
You no doubt hear from journalists in Papua New Guinea. What do they tell you?
So they often tell us that they find it difficult to access information. There are no clear protocols over where to obtain information. And when they try to seek information, they face rejection. And this is clearly because there's a lack of a proper framework around this. But many also fear writing and exposing issues because of the lack of a proper mechanism to protect them when they do so. So I think there are real challenges, particularly those who work in more rural areas, who are looking at development projects, who are looking at kind of mining issues. They also face threats, not just from the state, but also non-state actors from companies, and there really needs to be a comprehensive approach to ensure the protection of journalists in Papua New Guinea.
You have listed a number of recommendations. If we could look at some of those, what are you saying that the government needs to do?
I think firstly, we are calling on the government to move forward and establish this National Human Rights Institution. We know that there's already been some discussions around this within the Human Rights Secretariat, and I think we need to expedite and move that forward. The freedom of information legislation, which many civil society groups in Papua New Guinea have been pushing for, that needs to move forward. But we also need to review and look at laws that create a chilling effect for journalists, activists, and others, particularly the Cybercrime Act. And ultimately, it's about creating an enabling environment for freedom of expression and freedom of assembly. I think that's critical for Papua New Guinea to improve their status of civic space.
The government over the last 7 or 8 months has been endeavouring to bring in some sort of a council to control the media or to police the media. What is your feeling about that?
From what we've heard from the information, again, not all details have been made public. There are some positive elements of that media law which will afford some protections to the media. But I think clearly there are concerns about increasing restrictions within that policy or law. We've heard that from various groups, both locally and also internationally. And also to ensure that anything that's published is within the kind of national values of Papua New Guinea. So again, these are very broad and very vague terms and could be easily used to target or to prosecute journalists. So there must be an open process around this media law and to ensure that all stakeholders involved, but most importantly, they must be consistent with Papua New Guinea's international human rights obligations, which are clear within international law and the constitution.
That's Pacific Waves for today. To listen back, head over to rnzi.com/programs. We're also on Spotify, Apple, and iHeartRadio. From myself and the RNZ Pacific team, so far, so far.